You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Though justice be thy plea, remember this, that in the course of justice, none of us will find salvation. Law professor Kenji Yoshino can't say Portia didn't warn him about the limitations of justice in The Merchant of Venice, but he responded to the warning by creating a law school course based on the Bard's plays. It's become one of the most popular classes at NYU Law School, and now he's written a book called A Thousand Times More Fair, which makes the material accessible for all of us without decent LSAT scores. It's published by Echo, and I'm very pleased to welcome Kenji Yoshino to our show today. Hello.
Hello. Thanks so much for having me.
Did you wish there was a course like this when you were in law school?
There was, in fact, a course like this called Law and Literature, and I have to say that that course taught by Peter Brooks in the English department at Yale Law School was, or the English department at Yale, I should say, was...
With the Peter Brooks?
The Peter Brooks, yes. He was not Peter Brooks, the director, Peter Brooks, the literary critic, but from my perspective, he is the Peter Brooks, in the sense that he really saved the law school experience in many ways for me, because they say that law school sharpens a mind by narrowing it. And I think that it's really important, at least in your last years in law school, to sort of open up your horizons again and to situate those questions of law and questions of justice again.
But you'd come to this as an English major in college.
I had, indeed. And, you know, I don't want to slam law school here. I really enjoyed law school and many of the things that law school promised me, you know, the language of power, the capacity to make difference and causes that I cared about, various civil rights causes. It really gave to me. I think that one thing that it didn't give to me, though, was this idea of closing the gap between law and justice. So that's what this Law and Literature course did for me. That's what I'm trying to do for my students with the Shakespeare in the Law course.
But you wanted to write a thesis along these lines and ran into some resistance?
Yes, this book, actually.
Aren't lawyers famous for not being able to write well unless they quit and become novelists?
Well, I do feel like so many of my colleagues have gone into the thriller genre that I feel like if I stay too much longer in the legal profession, I'll be forced to write a thriller. But leaving that aside, I do think that one of the great things that my law professor gave me back when I was a student now, 16 or 17 years ago, was that I had a fight with him, Leonard, about whether or not I could write a piece about law and Shakespeare. And he said, no. You were an English major. I understand. I've had this conversation 100 times. It's time to leave childish things behind, and you need to understand the coercive, violent practices of the law. So go look at the Federal Rules of Procedure. Go look at the United States Constitution. Don't look at Shakespeare. You're done with that. And I thought about it, and I went back to him, and I said, you know, I still really believe that these two enterprises are linked to each other. I mean, law is a textual enterprise, just like literature is a textual enterprise. So let me at least take a stab at this. And to his great credit, he let me do that. And many years later, I think that it has come into fruition.
Well, how aware was Shakespeare of the law of his time?
I think extremely aware. I mean, Mark Twain thought that the author of the plays could not be the William Shakespeare of Stratford precisely because he knew too much about law. So I don't want to associate myself with that position at all. But I do want to say that Shakespeare knew a lot about law. And I think it was partly because he was just in part in the mix of London culture. And that culture really had a lot of law as part of its ambient culture and as its ambient knowledge. So if you look at other contemporaries of Shakespeare, like Marlowe, you see a lot of law in their plays as well, and they certainly weren't lawyers.
Although Shakespeare seems to be doing all these legal things in Venice and other parts of Italy or Denmark or whatever. Wasn't your course originally called Law and Literature as well?
Yes. Initially, I taught a law and literature class very much on the lines that Peter Brooks taught me, and the idea there was to just situate law within various legal texts. One of my favorite quotes is from this law and literature scholar who says, for every constitution, there's an epic. For every decalogue, there's a scripture. So the idea is that there is no formal piece of law that isn't embedded in a set of narratives that give it shape and meaning. So I taught that class, and then over time just got frustrated because we'd skip from author to author. And then I thought, if I wanted to teach this course under the canopy of one author, who better than Shakespeare?
And it's become very popular. I don't want to offend you, but is it considered a soft course on the school?
It's interesting. I had that fear because many law and literature critics say, you know, this is just a soft option or this is like a vacation from taking law. I actually view it as exactly the opposite. I view it as a really necessary recuperation from what the law students have gone through, which is to say, in their first years, they've been told that they have to set aside the facts that they find interesting, including facts about justice, and to fixate only on the facts that are of legal relevance. And I think that literature allows us to restore a broader universe of facts to them. And so I think it's actually a really important part of their moral education rather than being, you know, a soft kind of option. And keep in mind, too, Leonard, we're not reading like The Firm or, you know, trivial texts about the law. We're reading really important canonical texts that actually suggest that there's a broader world out there of justice beyond the narrow one of law.
Well, you begin your book with Titus Andronicus. Is it fair to say that it's not one of Shakespeare's almost one of his better plays, although Julie Taymor seemed to like it?
Yes, that's totally fair. In fact, Coleridge, you're being very kind because Coleridge went one step further than you and said that it was one of the stupidest plays ever written. Not by Shakespeare, stupidest plays written ever, period, you know, at the time when Coleridge was writing.
There's an awful lot of violence in it to the point of almost of near absurdity.
Right. So, you know, people's hands get lopped off. People get, you know, murdered by their own fathers. People get killed in true Senecan fashion and baked into pies. And so the question is, why would I ever spend any time with this play? Why would Taymor spend any time with this play? And my answer there is to say that this is a play about revenge cycles and where revenge cycles can lead. And when you think about Shakespeare's time, revenge cycles were a very, very serious threat because the state was very weak. So Shakespeare's nation, England, had no standing army and no effective police force. So in that kind of nation, when some harm happens to you, you have two choices. One, you can just turn the other cheek and do nothing, effectively just relying on the state, which will do nothing. Alternatively, you can take justice into your own hands and engage in a private vendetta. So which do you choose? So Shakespeare portrays Titus as engaging in a very natural impulse of vengeance against the person who has harmed his family. But on the other hand, he shows where that natural vengeance cycle leads because the tit for tat never ends. And I want to say that, you know, going forward to contemporary instances, we're much more like the Elizabethans, Leonard, than we are like the Victorians, in the sense that we're on a global theater where there is no effective global governance. And so again, when terrorists fly planes into our buildings, we have to decide whether or not to rely on some global set of governance that is going to do nothing or, you know, very little, or alternatively, whether or not to take justice into our own hands.
Well, how to deal with someone like Muammar Gaddafi.
Exactly.
But so you think that's why there's been a revival of interest in this play despite its inadequacies?
Yes. I mean, Taymor's production was highly acclaimed. Earlier productions like Peter Brook, now the other Peter Brook that you mentioned,
with Laurence Olivier.
Exactly. And there have actually been many, many other, you know, spoofs or musicals or whatever around Titus Andronicus that have been extremely popular.
Well, you talked about quarrels that spiral into bloody feuds. That's what inspired Romeo and Juliet as well, isn't it?
Absolutely. So I think that you said earlier that Titus is kind of a immature play, and I think that over Shakespeare's corpus, the revenge theme actually matures. So in some sense, what we see in Romeo and Juliet is the same conflict, only in medias res. You know, we're dropped into the conflict. We don't know what set off the Montagues and Capulets in their fight. We just know that they're these two feuding clans. And it's only Romeo and Juliet's death at the end, you know, each side sacrificing an individual from their side, that ultimately leads to peace, at least we hope, between the two clans.
Do you teach the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan in your constitutional law class?
I do indeed. And I actually get criticized often for the kind of lovingly gruesome, quote-unquote, way in which I teach those classes, because I talk about the ways in which people are harmed, and I talk about the body parts that were found after 9/11. And so when I had the opportunity to teach Titus Andronicus, I tried to make those connections to say, we actually need to understand how gruesome and how visceral the spectacle that we were confronted with in the wake of 9/11 to understand our own totally understandable but totally self-destroying notions of vengeance that were precipitated by those images.
Well, by going into Afghanistan to get rid of the Taliban and go after al-Qaeda, were we engaging in a blood feud, or were we simply defending our national interests? A country was harboring people who attacked us.
Yeah, I want to be really careful about how to address that, because I think that there are multiple motives there. And I also don't want to move too quickly from saying that the United States as a nation is simply the same as an individual who is wreaking justice on their own. But what I do want to say is that what we need to understand is that there is a vengeful component that we need to be very mindful of in what we did. And that vengeful component is much more likely to find expression the weaker the government is. So the weaker the rule of law is, the more likely it is that we're going to turn to private vendetta. And I think that we need to be very vigilant, particularly in a global situation where there is no global government, to keep that vengeful impulse in check.
My guest is Kenji Yoshino, the Chief Justice Earl Warren Professor of Constitutional Law at New York University School of Law. Prior to that appointment, he was the Deputy Dean of Intellectual Life at Yale Law School. His book, A Thousand Times More Fair, What Shakespeare's Plays Teach Us About Justice, published by Echo. We will continue our conversation after this. We're back with law professor Kenji Yoshino. His book, A Thousand Times More Fair, What Shakespeare's Plays Teach Us About Justice, is published by Echo. The Merchant of Venice is a natural candidate for your class because of the legal structure involved in the play. How is the society portrayed in that play different from the anarchy of Titus?
It's very different in the sense that the rule of law is very strong.
And everybody submits to it.
Exactly. And so one of the questions that Antonio gets, a merchant of the title, when Shylock is trying to exact his pound of flesh is, why do you think the Duke is going to enforce this contract? It's an unconscionable contract. You can't contract for a pound of flesh. And Antonio says, actually, because the law of Venice is, you know, because Venice is a port city and open to all comers, the law has to be really rigorously enforced. And so we're looking at the opposite extreme from what we had in Titus, where there is no rule of law.
Well, Portia, who to modern audiences initially is a very sympathetic character, manipulates all of these things and becomes less sympathetic.
Exactly. So my take on this play is that we've had many, many sympathetic portrayals of Shylock, but I don't think people have fully internalized the idea that if you have a more sympathetic portrayal of Shylock, you're going to have a less sympathetic portrayal of Portia, because the two characters are kind of on a pulley system. They're natural adversaries. And what I try and argue in this chapter is that Portia is never bound by any of the legal strictures. And so she kind of exacts revenge through other means, so that the rule of law is very solid. But then the question becomes, doesn't this just transfer the power towards the individuals who are capable of manipulating the law? So there's no outcome in any of the three trials that I see in the play that isn't exactly congruent to Portia's will.
Well, how would this apply today? Obviously, the trial would be very different, but in the end, Shylock still would be unlikely to collect his pound of flesh.
Yes. I mean, right now, I mean,
just he'd be forced to take a fine, wouldn't he?
To be really cautious about this or lawyerly about this, you know, today, and even in Shakespeare's time, the pound of flesh contract would not have been enforceable. Again, it's what would be known as an unconscionable contract. So in the same way that I can't contract with you to sell you my kidney or even to sell you my blood, you know, I can't contract with you for a pound of flesh. And that was true then as well. And so what we're really dealing with is a kind of theater law. But the important point here is that, let's say for the sake of a hypothetical, that this law would be upheld on the grounds that Antonio gives, which is to say that the law has to be strictly observed in Venice or people won't come to trade there. Then the question becomes, how do you get out of this? And one way in which you get out of it is by hiring an extremely good hair-splitting lawyer. And what Portia does in this play, as we all know, is to say, well, you can have your pound of flesh, but you can't have any blood that accompanies the flesh. And even a 19th century treatise that was commenting on this play said, this is a miserable pettifogging trick, you know, because this would mean that if I were to contract with you for a slice of melon, I would also have to contract with you for spilling of any incidental juice accompanying that slice.
Well, she also does lean a bit on the anti-Semitic aspects of the society to win that battle. And you say that her quality of mercy speech subtly guides Shylock away from choosing the option of mercy.
Yes, it's very interesting because the speech is so widely anthologized. But if you actually look at it, there are many things in it that seem to lead Shylock away from the merciful option. In other words, it seems like Shylock's imperviousness to the speech is a final symptom of his depravity. But in fact, there are many things that Portia does in order to guide him away from choosing that option. So she says, "Therefore, Jew, though justice be thy plea, consider this, that in the course of justice none of us should see salvation. We do pray for mercy, and that same prayer doth teach us all to render the deeds of mercy." And then she says, "You know, I have spoke thus much to mitigate the justice of thy plea, which if thou follow this strict court of Venice, must needs give sentence against the merchant there." So notice two things that are going on there, Leonard. One is that she's saying, "Therefore, Jew." She doesn't refer to him by his name. She refers to him by his religion. And then she says, "Though justice be thy plea," i.e. Old Testament justice, not New Testament mercy, "consider this, that in the course of justice, none of us should see salvation." What salvation is she talking about there? She's talking about Christian salvation, right? And so when she said, "Earthly justice doth gentle like as God's when mercy seasons justice," what she's really talking about is a Christian form of salvation. So Shylock, in being persuaded by that argument, could be being converted to a different form of belief.
Do you see her as a good lawyer?
I see her as an excellent lawyer, but I see her as a very scary lawyer in the sense that she's so silver-tongued and she's such a sophist that she's able to talk the skin off a snake. And I would, returning to actually that passage, the end of that passage is really important because at the end she says, you know, "Look, you know, here's the claim for mercy." But then she says, "I've spoke thus much to mitigate the justice of thy plea. But if you don't actually take up my plea, then you're entitled to the pound of flesh." So she actually says, if you don't pick mercy, this other, you know, option is still available to you. And the anthologies don't actually include that. They always cut it off at the more positive rendition of the word mercy.
You compare Bill Clinton's performance related to the Monica Lewinsky affair to Portia's performance in the courtroom.
Yeah, only on this very narrow ground, which is to say that
hair-splitting?
Yes. So when he was asked whether or not he had had sexual relations with Monica Lewinsky, he says, "It all depends on what the word is. And I think that that's the point where he, as an extremely charismatic, extremely prepossessing individual, sort of slipped into lawyer speak, and he lost the kind of hearts and minds of many people in the country. So the idea is that, you know, Clinton, like Portia, is extremely prepossessing and attractive as an individual. But there's a moment where he gets pushed to the wall, where he resorts to legal hair splitting. And I think it was George Will who said this is a point at which things just took a completely postmodern turn. And I think that in some ways, context would have helped there. He was really talking about the tense of the word to be. But in some ways, George Will, I think, got it right in the sense that the sentence makes more sense without context, ironically, than with context, because it just sounds like utter, you know, hair splitting and shenanigans with language that we associate with lawyers. So at that point, Bill Clinton stopped being our, you know, one of our most revered presidents and started to sound much more like a lawyer. And there are moments in Merchant of Venice where Portia makes the exact same move.
Although I think Americans forgave him after that.
I think Americans probably forgive
Portia, too.
Shakespeare
forgives Portia.
Yeah.
She has, in the end, she winds up back on top in the last scene, although she's marrying a man who's definitely beneath her.
Right. Well, we have this problem with lots of Shakespearean heroines, right? Like, we don't think that Bassanio's worthy of Portia, but we don't think Orlando's worthy of Rosalind, and we don't think that Orsino's worthy of Viola.
Well, you mentioned George Will. Let's talk about Gary Wills for a moment. He gave you what has to be considered a negative review here, although I didn't exactly understand what his concerns were.
Yeah, so reading between the lines, I think that he did give me, you can consider a negative review when somebody says that some projects, I'm joking about reading between the lines, I think his negativity was clear in the face of the review. He said that some law and literature enterprises sort of ennoble both enterprises and some diminish both. And I frankly have to admit to being a little bit puzzled by this. You know, you have professional Shakespeareans like Stephen Greenblatt and Harold Bloom endorsing the book. You have, you know, a Supreme Court justice, now retired, Justice Stevens, endorsing the book on the law side. You have Judge Richard Posner endorsing it. So given that Wills is neither a professional Shakespearean nor a lawyer, I was a little bit puzzled by where he was drawing on the authority to say that this enhanced neither law nor literature. Of course, he's entitled to his own opinion, and this is all just a shorthand for a much longer conversation I would love to have with him. But, You know, I would just say that for starters. There are a couple of other weird moments in that review, Leonard. I think one was when he took me to task for having an article 15 years ago that I published in the Yale Law Journal of Law and Humanities that he viewed to be inconsistent with the book. And that just is such a bizarre comment to make that, it sort of beggars the imagination. I don't really have a way of responding to that claim. You know, am I supposed to be consistent? Can I not write over time with respect to my views on The Merchant of Venice, even if I'm talking about different issues in the play? The other thing that he said that was really weird was that Brabantio had to have been deemed to be a more positive character than I view him to be. Bassanio in The Merchant of Venice had to be a more positive character because the actor Richard Burbage played him. Well, Richard Burbage played Richard III. Is he saying that we should have a more positive view of Richard III? It just gets very muddled to me.
Let's talk about Othello. You asked yourself if a tragedy like Othello's could happen in our time, and what answer did you come up with?
I say absolutely, along the dimension of ocular proof. You know, so
what is ocular proof? Ocular proof bias you talk about.
Exactly. So ocular proof is what Othello demands of Iago. So Iago is trying to convince Othello that Othello's wife Desdemona has been unfaithful. And he pours all the sickening innuendo in Othello's ear. And then Othello is finally pushed past all endurance. And then he catches hold of Iago and says, "Give me ocular proof." You know, i.e., give me hard physical evidence that
smoking
I can touch
gun.
And see. It's more than just a smoking gun. It's the idea that you have a piece of physical evidence that Othello can actually see and touch. And Iago provides him with Desdemona's handkerchief spotted with strawberries, which Othello has given to Desdemona as a love token. And this is enough for Othello to convict. So he becomes judge, jury, and executioner. Flashing forward, in the 1995 O.J. Simpson trial, I argue that the bloody black glove performs the same role as the white handkerchief in Othello. And so in both cases, when you can't sort of measure what's important, you make important what you can measure. And so what happens is that the defense attorney, Johnny Cochran, tries to funnel all of our attention towards the bloody black glove, saying, if it doesn't fit, you must acquit.
But it's interesting that in the case of Othello, he decides that she's guilty when we know she's innocent. In the case of the O.J. Simpson trial, most people assumed, I don't know for sure, I wasn't there, but assumed that he was guilty, but he was acquitted.
Right. So what I'm focusing on is less whether or not there's a conviction or acquittal, but whether or not we reach the right verdict. So I actually have stronger views on this. I believe that, you know, Othello wrongfully convicted Desdemona, and I believe that the jury wrongfully acquitted O.J. Simpson. And I believe that they reached the wrong conclusion in both instances because of this ocular proof bias. Notice that when Johnny Cochran says, if it doesn't fit, you must acquit, originally he's talking about the prosecution's entire case. So he's not actually speaking about the bloody glove. But as it gets received by popular culture, it suddenly becomes, if the glove doesn't fit, you must acquit. And that betrays something very dangerous about our need to focus on hard evidence. When the metaphysical questions become hard, we focus on the physical evidence.
Now, we have very little time left, but there are two other plays that we just have to address, and maybe you can compress them as much as possible, but two great plays, Macbeth and Hamlet, also with legalistic issues in them.
Yes.
Hamlet pretty much becomes judge and jury.
Yes. Let me talk about them in the opposite order. So Hamlet, I view the problem in Hamlet as being this idealistic young man who is insistent in his pursuit of perfect justice. And I argue that perfect justice, while seemingly very desirable, is actually very dangerous. So there are seven dead bodies on the stage that don't need to be there because Hamlet can't deal with rough justice, either with respect to the issue of whether Claudius is guilty or with respect to the question of whether Claudius is going to be properly penalized if Hamlet stabs him while he's at prayer. If you're praying, then your soul goes straight to heaven if you're killed while you're praying. And so Hamlet stays his hand, but then seven other people need to die. With Macbeth, this is actually one of my favorite chapters, so it's a great note to go out on, so thank you. With Macbeth, what I do is I take aim at the idea of natural justice. So Macbeth seems to be this very dark play, but I argue that it's an opposite of a problem comedy. It's kind of a reassurance tragedy, if you will, because all the people who do bad things ultimately get punished, and the punishment follows as night follows unto day. And there's a kind of puckish, kind of comical turn here because the cover of the book is actually a scene from Macbeth. And it looks like this very regal figure who is actually sitting in judgment. But if you pan out on the figure, then you actually see that it's Macbeth instructing the murderers. And so if the question is a thousand times more fair than what, the answer is a thousand times more fair than this.
So you're saying because he gets his comeuppance just in the natural course of things, we all feel satisfied that that justice will win out.
More than that, Leonard, it's a real cognitive fallacy. I think it's really dangerous to think that there's this kind of karmic, imbalance that will always be righted. So I actually talk about it in the context of Martin Luther King Jr. and then President Obama's gloss on it. Martin Luther King Jr., Dr. King, said once that the moral arc of justice was long, but it bent towards justice. And then President Obama, Martin Luther King Day recently, had this beautiful gloss on that speech. He said, yes, it does bend towards justice, but it doesn't bend on its own. We make it bend by putting our hand on it. And I think that that's actually one of the messages that we need to take away from Macbeth, which is to say that Macbeth's comeuppance isn't going to come naturally. The curse that supposedly attends Macbeth in the theater, where if you say Macbeth and bad things happen to you, I want to argue is a modern-day instantiation of that theme of natural justice. And I think that we need to set our faces against it if we want to achieve the kind of justice that President Obama was discussing.
So no more about the Scottish play. Kenji Yoshino is Chief Justice Earl Warren Professor of Constitutional Law at New York University School of Law. His previous book was a memoir called Covering, and now he's written A Thousand Times More Fair, What Shakespeare's Plays Teach Us About Justice, published by Echo. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thanks so much for having me.